Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and welcome to Bayfield in Bloom. And wow, tell you, we have a packed house. We have a packed house here, and we're broadcasting from Bayfield, Wisconsin today to kick off a month-long celebration of, oh my goodness, how many flowers? I think something like over 50,000 blooming daffodils right now, and a mosaic, as they say, of roadside lupine, and we've got the orchards with the wonderful apple blossoms bursting. Some really rosy, beautiful colors, and it's a great time to be here. It's also a kickoff for, we planted a tree. Don Kissinger, one of our guests today, planted a tree in sort of honor of Arbor Day. And it's just a wonderful experience to be here with a very large crowd of people. And three people who have been with me for quite a long time now. This is my 14th year. This is the 14th year of Bayfield in Bloom and my 14th year coming up here. So it's been wonderful, and I think Art Odie's been here every single time. Art is a horticulture consultant, semi-retired now, from manager from the Botanical Garden and Arboretum. And Art Odie, thanks for being with us today.
Larry, I don't remember getting older in 14 years, do you?
You don't look any older. You don't look any...
Looks can be deceiving.
Okay. Well, Don Kissinger doesn't look any older either. Don is with the Department of Natural Resources. He coordinates urban and community forestry programs. And Don, great to have you back.
Thank you, Larry. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, well, you're not looking any older either. And Jason Fischbach isn't very old to begin with.
That's right.
But he's probably the smartest one of the bunch of the four of us here. And he is he's the ag agent for Ashland and Bayfield counties, and he knows a lot about gardens, both flower and vegetables. Jason, welcome back.
Thanks. Welcome to Bayfield, Larry.
Oh, I tell you what, it is so wonderful to be here. And Art Odie, maybe just say a word about Bayfield in Bloom, because it is a great celebration.
Well, the first thing I would say is that Bayfield blooms a lot later than the rest of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Our daffodils are just now over the hill. But we had a good daffodil display. There's still a few to be seen out there. Everything else is blooming just about on time. The June berries are in bloom, beautiful white blooms all over the landscape. The sugar maples are still in bloom. And if you haven't noticed sugar maples in bloom, you really ought to. They're an awesomely beautiful tree.
Yeah, they're wonderful to see. And we have, obviously, we're taking calls. I should give the number, 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call, same old number, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Jennifer Dargan's back there taking your calls back in the Madison in our studios. Thank you, Jennifer. She's our on-air producer today. Again, give us a call with your questions and comments. We'd love to hear from you. Jason, how's the spring looking here in this northern part of the state?
Well, this is always the time of year we're all nervous. Anyone who relies on flowers for their business, this is the time where we get nervous. There's cold weather tonight and tomorrow night, and we're too far along in bloom, so hopefully we get through it. But we go through this every year.
Yeah, absolutely every year. Emerald ash borer, Don Kissinger, has it made its appearance in this part of the state yet?
Well, it hasn't gotten here yet that I know of, but it has kind of in the neck of the woods where I live in Portage and Wood County. Wood County, just last week in Wisconsin Rapids, it was found, and about a month prior to that in Stevens Point it was. So it is moving ever northward.
And municipalities dealing with that right now? I don't even know how many counties are.
There's 41 counties that have been quarantined. However, 37 of those actually have fines in them. So those four counties might be like the donut hole type situation where there's EAB all around there. But in working with communities, a lot of them have put together emerald ash borer plans. And some of the communities I spoke to recently are actually starting to inject trees, treat trees, and preemptively removing some trees if trees aren't in good shape. So I'm glad to say that a lot of those communities are preparing, and hopefully all of them will be, because it definitely is will be an effect on the community budgets.
Yeah, and I'm forgetting it's, 72 counties here in the state, so we got a little over half already.
Yep. And another thing, too, the residents really need to look at and be able to identify their ash trees in their yards and determine if they're worth treating, because I can guarantee you that if you do have an ash tree and you don't treat them, they will die eventually.
Yeah.
So it's not a if, it's a when.
And I mean, if you're for one tree or a couple trees, the cost on treatment isn't too bad, is it?
If you could do it. And it's very dependent on size. Trees that are about 20 inches in diameter and less, homeowners can buy products at stores, mix them with water, and put them at the base of the tree. That's typically done in the spring of the year. Trees that are larger than that, they're going to need to work with a certified arborist to have them injected, and the price can be a little bit more. So on average, it depends, but I would say the homeowner type thing, it's an every year type of regiment. The larger trees is in every other year, and it could be $3 to $4 for the smaller size tree per diameter inch, and up to $8 to $10 per diameter inch for the larger trees, which is using a different chemical, and that might be an every other year type of administration.
Okay, so it could add up over time, but
yes.
if you've got a beautiful tree out there, you want to
definitely. And I guess the thing that I like to push is that, especially because working with communities is, yes, trees are aesthetically pleasing, but they do a lot of work for us. I mean, stormwater retention, especially in the area that we're here now, Bayfield, Ashland, Washburn, making sure that water is retained, goes to the roots, into the soil, and not into Lake Superior.
Yeah.
So it's cleaner water. So also cutting down on energy for your home, so that type of thing. So very important. They work very hard for us.
Well, we have callers online with questions. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. And again, I'm also inviting our audience members. If you have a question, just raise your hand, and Joe Nadeau will come around and thrust the microphone in front of you to ask your question. But let's turn to the telephones right now, and let's go to Don in Iron River. Don, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm Iron River. I got a question for Jason. I'm wondering if morel mushrooms grow up here in this northern part of Wisconsin. I know there was oodles of them down in southern Wisconsin.
They do, but nobody tells you where they are is the problem.
Yeah.
I've myself not been out looking, but I know there are folks that look for them up here.
We have a cabin that is north of Hayward, about 25 miles north and east. And last year, I got a call from one of my buddies who was at the cabin, and he said, geez, we were walking along the roadside, and we picked pretty much a bushel basket of morel mushrooms right on the roadside. So and I said, there weren't any dead homes there? No, they were just kind of growing in the grass. So I had some of those, and they were good, for sure. So they do grow, but I think Jason's probably right. Nobody ever wants to tell you where.
That's right. Would you?
No. I actually picked some last weekend in southern Wisconsin near Janesville. So there I told you right where it was. A woods near Janesville. Oh, my goodness. Well, Don, have you found any yourself? No,
well,
he's gone.
No,
so that's
gonna,
all right. Let's take another call. Cheryl in Duluth, Minnesota has a question. Cheryl, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling to find out if you've ever experienced something that looks like fruit flies this time of the year in your house. They're hovering around my seeded items that I plan to put out one day, but I was wondering if there's a way to get rid of them.
Fruit, they look like fruit flies.
A couple of guesses. You can try to get a sticky board. You can buy it usually at any garden center and just put it right above the plants and see what you catch, but it could be something like fungus gnats or white flies, most likely. White flies you'd notice because they're white, but probably fungus gnats. Sometimes if you have algae growing on the top of that the soil at the surface because there's too much nutrients, there's too wet for too long. The fungus gnats like that that algae growth.
All right, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take a question from the audience. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Zona, and I'm from Hurley. And we've been trying to grow blueberries in our clay soil and have not been very successful. So someone has told me honeyberries are the answer. So I'm just wondering if folks up north here are growing honeyberries and if they've been successful.
Honeyberries. I'm not sure about I don't know honeyberries. Jason, sure. Do you know?
Yeah, it's definitely worth trying. There's two varieties, Tundra and Borealis, that you could try. They don't have the same sort of acid requirements that blueberries do, but they also don't like clay. Nothing likes clay. Not the pure red clay that we have. So if you can amend that soil well, even bringing in peat moss or bringing in rotted compost, or building a raised bed, you know, at the homeowner scale where it's 4, 5, 6 plants or so, that's pretty easy to do. Raised bed, bring in some better soil, and you can mix it a bit with that surface with the clay and try it that way.
Jason, I'm not familiar with that common name. Could you tell me?
Honeyberry? Yeah, it's... I'm not sure I remember the species name on it, but it's a little blue berry. Not a blueberry, but a blue berry.
Right? There we go.
Take a look, and it's catching on more and more because it is really winter hardy. That's the big advantage of it. It really does not suffer winter damage at all.
And would that grow anywhere in the state, you think, Jason?
I believe so. It's worth a try. You could check with folks down in the southern part of the state with your extension agents to see if they have any experience with it. But
yeah, all right. Well, let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Shelley from Ashland. I'm just wondering, getting ready for the garden season, do you have any opinion on using garden mats in your garden as far as you see advertisements for that now? It's called garden mats that have the holes already in and helping with the weeds?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a really great strategy, I think. If you amend the soil well and you have a good way to water underneath those mats, most of them are, the water will percolate through okay. And you can make these on your own. It's kind of fun, actually. You can just buy some landscape fabric. The plastic shouldn't be too flammable, right? Now we're getting somewhere here. And you build a frame out of plywood and drill holes in it so that they're spread out with the planting density that you would use. Put that frame on top of that landscape fabric on the driveway, right? Something hard that's not going to burn. And then take a little handheld blowtorch and burn holes in the landscape fabric. That's the heat seals the edges of it. And now you've got a nice hole in that landscape fabric. You put the landscape fabric down after you've done all your soil prep and put your plants right in those holes. And now your weeds aren't going to grow, because it's totally smothered. And then you can just, at the end of the year, pull the plants out if these are annuals, and then lift up the landscape fabric, put it away from the winter, and use it for a few years, 3, 4, 5 years. The weed mats, if they're, you know, you can make these out of cardboard, too. They just biodegrade is another, if you want them to turn into mulch or compost, you can go that route, too. But landscape fabric's nice because it lasts a long time.
Very, very cool. You can join in, too, as you listen to the show at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org as we broadcast from Bayfield and Bloom for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next week on Garden Talk, but right now from Bayfield and Bloom, visiting with Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties, Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, and Art Odie, Horticulture Consultant, semi-retired manager from the Botanical Garden and Arboretum. Great to have them all along. And we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. I've got to say a quick thanks to the Ashland-Bayfield County Master Gardener Group, who I love these people. Every year I come up here, it's about on my birthday, and I'm presented with a birthday card that I have to go home and frame because it's so beautifully painted. And I have some wonderful, I don't know if you'd call them cupcakes, they're enormous, but thanks to the gang at the Ashland-Bayfield Master Gardener Group. It's a wonderful, wonderful group. Thank you so much. And we have a question from the audience, and then we'll take some phone calls. Hello.
Hi, I'm Linda from Superior, and I was wondering if I could get some suggestions to help with growing morning glories. My grandmother, as I was growing up, had this gorgeous mass of morning glories all the time, and I'm trying to carry on that tradition, but I have not been very successful. I've tried seeds, I've tried buying the plants already started, and we live in Superior, so of course there's clay, but I wondered if there was anything I could do to try to have this happen.
Huh. Art, do you want to any ideas, or Jason, a comment?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd ask, you are talking about morning glories, the annual, not about clematis, right?
Yes. No, I want morning glories. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't think there'd be any problem if the soil is right.
Jason? I have.
I mean, I hear clay soil, and I, you know, cringe and growing anything because it can be so difficult to manage. And I think really paying attention to the quality of that soil and amend it well. I mean, you really should be able to, in the spring, grab a handful of that soil when it's dried out a little bit, and it should crumble in your hands. If it's always hanging on to water and it turns into a clay pot, it's just too much clay to grow anything. So especially with the annual flowers, flower beds, you really can afford to amend that soil really well. Put in some soil as potting mix if you have to and try it that way. And I think buying starts instead of from seed is a good way to go. Try to buy them as young as you can, actually, not nice and big and full and flowering, because you don't want that transplant shock. So buy them young and amend that soil, and you should have better luck.
Maybe they have some here for sale. I don't know. I'm looking back, and we've got lots of things for sale here in the Bayfield Pavilion. So you might find one or two of them growing right here. You know, I was interested. Art, I don't know if it's you who is talking about naturalizing daffodils.
Well, we've kind of done the whole thing here over the years. We've been naturalizing daffodils for at least as long as we've had the radio show here. So there's a few things that we've learned, and I guess the big thing that I've learned is that daffodils are like tulips. I mean, they really do best in a garden bed where they have room to grow and they're not crowded out by grass and so forth. But if you do want to naturalize daffodils, there's some very simple do's and don'ts. And one of the don'ts is, if you are going to plant daffodils in your lawn, you have to be sure that you don't mow that grass before the daffodil leaves dry off. And even one early mowing will really knock those bulbs back for years. So don't try and naturalize daffodils unless you are not going to be too neat about things.
Yeah.
Neatness and naturalized daffodils don't go together. The other thing that we've really learned over the years is that where snow and ice sit all winter, the daffodils just don't bloom. They may survive, but they don't bloom. So naturalizing daffodils is not tricky, but you don't want to be neat about it.
Yeah, and am I right in saying there are about 50,000 daffodils in the area here?
I think that's how many we planted, at least that many. Whether that many survive to this day, I don't know. But we've been pretty successful.
Yeah, I guess so. 50,000 is pretty good. Pretty good number. Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Don from Washburn. One of the questions I had is regarding the tree disease fire blight. Is that very prevalent here? I've got a number of apple trees and so on, and just wanted to get a read on that.
It is here, and some years it can be really bad. It's, you know, the disease everyone's afraid of as a commercial apple grower. And it's always around. It's just waiting for the right environmental conditions at bloom for it to strike. And 4 years ago, we had it real bad, and we're still suffering the consequences from it. The other thing that has happened over the years, we've had some really bad winters. This was 2-3 years ago, and it opened a lot of cracks in the bark. And so we've had apple trees dying ever since.
those cracks open up and we get fire blight and other fungal diseases in there, and it takes a while, but the cankers form and eventually kills these apple trees. So it's a major problem. Some apple variety and rootstock combinations are more resistant to fire blight than others. So if you're looking to establish new apple trees, definitely pay attention, ask the nurseries, ask the sellers what kind of rootstock they have, and buy stuff that's resistant.
Yeah, there we go.
Hey, Larry, I did want to jump in. There's a great new resource while we're talking about fruit for your audience, and it's a fruit growers newsletter that's available through UW Extension at fruit.wisc.edu. It's new this year. We're in our third issue so far, and the third issue just came out today with articles about grapes, apple disease, hazelnuts, and the whole goal is to put that out weekly all summer long. So it's a great resource, brand new. And
that is cool.
It's pitched toward commercial growers, but homeowners can definitely read it and understand it and get a lot out of it too. So
fruit.wisc.edu.
Correct, yep. So have at it.
Get on that list myself. I'm not on it. Well, another great question. Because there was a caller with a question about apples as well, let's take that call from Ashley in Coloma. Ashley, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a few apple trees in my yard, and there are like these webbed nests of worms. And someone told me that those might kill the tree. So I was wondering, how do I get rid of them? And they're on just little branches. So can I cut the nest off with the branch without hurting the tree?
All right.
I guess what I think you could do is you could just take the insects out of the nest if you can with a rake or gloved hand, put it in soapy water, and those will die. And actually, if you did nothing to it, the tree would do okay. That limb that it's on, those leaves aren't going to come. Well, they may come back midsummer again, but it's not going to kill the tree. I guess I wouldn't recommend cutting the limb off because, again, it will come back, you know, either midsummer or will come back next year. So if you can handle putting gloves on and taking it out that way or with a rake, that's really the easiest way to do that. Something that I have heard and seen people do is using blowtorches. That is not a good thing because you won't have much of a tree left, but some people think that, you know, it's wise, and it's not.
Not the wisest thing. So there you go, Ashley. Your tree is actually okay. And let's take another question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, I'm Katie from Cable, and I have an apple tree question as well. We have a community farm where we planted 25 different kinds of fruit trees, and 2 years ago, most of them did well, except for one variety. We had five red barrens that all died over the winter, and it looks like it was rodent damage. So I've just today in Bayfield purchased five replacement trees. They're Wolf River. And my question is there any reason not to put them in the same hole as the ones that died to replace them?
So why do you think they were, was there girdling on the trees or?
All the way around.
All right.
So the concern is what we call replant disease. It's not a specific organism. It's just if a tree is growing there long enough, it accumulates pathogens, verticillium, phytophthora, things like that. So there is some risk if you replant there. You're replanting an area that has a higher density of those pathogens. The fact that the tree has only been there for a year and a half or two, I wouldn't worry about it. I think you're okay replanting. In those first few years, it's just going to be in its root ball space anyway. So I think you're okay replanting this year. Generally, though, if you're cutting out an old orchard, you don't want to replant apples within at least 3 years.
Okay. And in the meantime, to keep those rodents out next winter?
Yeah, the tree trunks need to be wrapped for at least a few years. With the spiral tree guard works fine.
Yeah. Or you could use hardware cloth, which is a wire type thing around them as well. But yeah, they're very succulent the first, you know, half dozen really years that they're out there.
I always thought hardware cloth was a terrible name for that. So, you know, it's like a screen, like on a
screen.
You're
correct.
Porch.
I mean, it is wire. It's wire, but it's called hardware cloth.
I know. I never figure out who thought that one up.
another tip, if you do have rodent damage on a fruit tree or other tree for that matter, you might consider doing some bridge grafting. It's easy enough to do it yourself There's plenty of instructions on the internet and wherever to do the bridge grafting, and you can really save a tree if you really want to spend the effort to do it.
Yeah, there we go. Well, let's take another question from the audience, then we'll go back to the phones. Hello.
Hi, I'm Julie from Cable. I've been studying unheated winter gardening, and I got really excited the other day. I'm new up here, and I saw an ad for the winter garden, but it's a greenhouse in winter.
Winter, Wisconsin.
Yes. So I wondered what you thought about the feasibility of that up here.
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's a lot happening up in our region right now. We call it deep winter gardening. And the idea is you design a structure that captures as much heat during the day and then gives it off at night to try to keep the plants just above, between 30 and 40 degrees. Above that, it's too expensive. Right now, you just have a heated greenhouse. There's a lot we don't know, but there's some great technologies out there for trapping that heat, storing it in water, what we call thermal mass, storing it in concrete, and then radiating it back out. So we also actually just submitted for some funding to run a trial with spinach to try to keep it growing all over the winter with as little possible heat as we can, and that involves frost blankets and a high tunnel, so an unheated greenhouse with a high tunnel. So there's potential there because, with the local food movement demanding fresh local produce, there's money to be made with some winter production, and if you can do it in a way that you're not running a full-scale heated hothouse, then there's some potential. Yeah,
it's great.
So stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. Let's take a call from Lacey in Whitewater next. Lacey, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have a question kind of related to apple trees, but more to cedars. We just purchased a house in the fall, and this spring, as everything's blooming, we noticed some orange flower-looking things on our cedar trees, but as we got closer, noticed that they were slimy and really gross. And in Googling them, we think that it's an apple cedar fungus, and the information we found online makes it sound like it's only dangerous to apple trees, which we don't have. And I'm wondering if it's dangerous to our cedars, if we should treat it or ignore it, and if we decided to add pear trees in the future, if it would be dangerous to those.
Okay. Art?
Well, it won't bother the pear trees as far as I know in my experience. It doesn't really damage the cedar trees. Now, we're talking about red cedar, not white cedar. Juniperus, Virginiana. If you don't like the looks of it, you could pluck those flowering if you want to use. But they won't do an awful lot of damage to your red cedar. But red cedar really should be planted within, I think Jason could help me with this, within a quarter of a mile of producing apples. The apple trees are the alternate host for the cedar apple rust, and they only affect the two species.
Yeah, Jason, you're nodding your head yes in agreement on that one.
Yeah, it's cedar apple rust, and as long as you have cedars, you're going to have it, and you have apples, you'll get it on your apples. And in fact, there's an article about it in this new newsletter, the Fruit Growers Newsletter. How about that for timing?
Ah, excellent. So,
if you're going to try to grow apples, you're going to have to deal with this as a pest, and it's a fungal pest that can cause some problems. It's usually a minor pest in apples, but it's still in the right year can be a problem.
So go to fruit.wisc.edu and get on the mailing list for that as well. Thank you very much, Lacey, for calling. Another caller or another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Bob from near Barksdale down the road, Highway 13 a ways. And I've got a small enclosed garden that's necessary to keep the deer at bay. And I try to make it a multifunctional space. And I've got some vegetables in there and also some raspberries and strawberries and blueberries. And when I read the instructions for raspberries, it said I should not have tomato plants or potatoes close to the raspberries, and it also says I should keep them away from wild raspberries or blackberries. And when I look around, the wild stuff is all around, and I really don't have a convenient place to put more potatoes or tomatoes, how much separation do I really need to be able to maintain a successful raspberry a crop there?
You can plant your potatoes in a bale.
Well, the question is having those potatoes and tomatoes that much more of a risk than if they weren't there in terms of the raspberry growth because of all the wild raspberries in the region and how fungal spores can move? Really, it's all about how you grow those raspberries to minimize chances of any disease growing, and that means doing a really good job removing the florecanes at the end of the year and then thinning in the spring so you've got good air movement within those raspberry plants and keeping the weeds down. If you do that, you know, you're 90% of the way toward clean raspberries. If you've got tomatoes and potatoes that are just so lush and shading the raspberries, and especially at the lower level of the raspberries, and you don't have airflow, the vegetable crops aren't going to cause the problem. They're just going to make it worse because they've got the restriction in the airflow. So I think go ahead and just grow whatever you want in that space and then just do what you can to keep the airflow in that raspberry patch. If you get to a point, there are fungicides you could use, organic or otherwise, to control some disease in those raspberries. But I think you're okay, just good pruning and management.
This has nothing to do with the raspberry diseases, but if you've got an enclosed area like that, add some chickens. It'll keep the insects down in your vegetable garden.
Not a bad idea. Art, Odie, thanks for that comment as well. I want to give David in Brookfield a chance to join us because he has something relating to pear trees, and their pears came up a little earlier, so let's go there. David, hi.
Hi. I have two pear trees, a Bartlett, and then the I think it's the ornamental or oriental. Is that correct? They've been planted for 5 years, and I haven't had any flowers yet.
5 years?
Where are you located?
Brookfield, so Milwaukee.
Okay. Too much nitrogen, maybe?
5 years, there should be some flowering by now. The Bartlett, the reason I asked where is Bartlett is not fully hardy for this far north, but down by Milwaukee, you should be okay. The pears want to grow upright, and that's all they do. And if they're growing upright, they just don't flower as much. So you've got to get those branches pulled down, try to get them horizontal as best you can. And eventually you should see some flowering. But otherwise, I think Art's right. You may have just too lush of growth and it's just not ready to flower. But if you pull those branches down, they'll start flowering.
And your oriental pear ought to bloom anyway.
Yeah.
Ours do up here, so you shouldn't have any trouble with them.
Yep. There we go. Thanks a lot for that question. And let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm up in Superior, and my question deals with plums. I have a Toca and a Superior. They're 7 years old, and just last year we finally started getting plums off of it. And my husband swears by the baseball bat method that Larry has mentioned a long time ago. Is that good for the trees?
Well, yeah. I like to take a baseball bat and swing at it and nail it once or twice if it's not producing, and then it decides it's probably a good idea to start producing. And actually, a horticulturist from the UW told me that once.
Yeah, you may have heard of ringing a tree or a branch, and what you're trying to do is just damage the cambium under the bark, and it slows down nutrient flow, and you can trick it into flowering. So that's what it's doing. You're damaging that cambium underneath the bark by hitting it with a baseball bat. So
is it okay for him to go out there?
Well,
I was actually thinking of that when the pear guy called here just a minute ago.
Right. You're better off manipulating branch angle and getting your branches to go horizontal than hitting it. But
oh, there we go. Let's take another question from the audience.
I'm Abby from Maguanago, and I actually have two questions. The first one is, on our way here, we saw a shrub or a tree that's in the understory that's blooming white right now. And what is that? And the other question is garlic mustard. If we keep mowing it down before it ever gets to grow, will it eventually die or does it have to be pulled? Shout out to Debbie.
Yeah. Art Odie.
First question regarding the flowering tree. This part of the state, I'd say from Wausau north, if you see anything blooming white in the understory, it's quite probably Juneberry, Amelanchier. There are two or three different Juneberries that that are native to Wisconsin, and that would be what you were seeing. Other than that, you might come across wild plum that are starting to bloom also. But right now, at least in our neck of the woods here, it would be the Juneberry. Amelanchier, the tree form is Amelanchier borealis, I think, and the shrub forms are Laevis and a couple other species. Very, very nice ornamental landscape trees as well.
Yeah, they're pretty and they really stand out. Now, as we were driving up from Madison yesterday, we saw lots of it. And the other question was, what's the other question? We all have our headphones on, so we can't hear anything unless somebody's talking into the microphone.
Jerry, it was garlic mustard.
Oh, garlic mustard. Okay. So if you keep mowing garlic mustard down before it goes to seed, are you going to eventually kill it?
In theory, yes. The question is how big of a seed bank has been developed over time in that spot, and it could take years and years and years to finally exhaust that seed bank. So anything you can do to keep it from flowering helps, but you're going to expect if it had been there for any time that it's going to be there for a lot longer too.
So just keep pulling at it.
Yeah, keep after it. And by the way, as you're listening in here, you can join in too on the telephone at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org and post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Luke from Potosi emailed and is looking into planting raspberries in a 4x8 raised bed. Wonders about varieties you'd recommend. He's from Cadott. For the highest yield for a small area, how many plants could I squeeze in an area 4x8? I don't know if you want to squeeze. It's probably the wrong term, isn't it, Jason?
Well, so 4x8, generally when you're growing fruit crops, you want as much edge as possible. So 4x8 is almost too big of a single block. So I think you'd want to look at least two hedgerows. My favorite variety, flavor-wise, it's really vigorous. It can be a little bit weepy, and the branches can break sometimes, but Royalty, it's a dark purple raspberry. It tastes just like raspberry jam, nice big fruit. So that's one to consider. Some of the old standbys like Nova or Killarney or Latham would be ones to try. Those would be the red raspberries. And you could consider a row of red raspberry summer bearing and then try some fall bearing as well, something like Autumn Britain. Or consider black raspberries. They're going to be pretty vigorous, but a variety like Jewel does really well. And black raspberries are pretty tasty and good for you. And once you figure out the pruning technique, it's pretty straightforward to grow them.
It's kind of cool. As I'm seeing quite a few people with their pencils out, and they're taking notes on this. This is a lot of fun. Broadcasting today from Bayfield to kick off a month-long Bayfield in Bloom celebration. It's really a lot of fun as we visit with Jason Fischbach, Don Kissinger, and Art Odie. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Isn't this fun? I love Garden Talk anyway, but it's a great time to be in Bayfield, Wisconsin, at the Bayfield Pavilion to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. And lots of great questions so far. You can join in if you have questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And callers online, and we've had some great questions from the audience today. We had a huge audience in front with us today. And I think Jill's taken some photos, and we have those photos up on our Facebook page. So there's some really cool ones. Chris in Wisconsin Dells had a suggestion to keeping mice away from trees. He suggests Tabasco to keep mice away from trees. So any, Don Kissinger?
I've heard that as well. Another thing that you want to do for the young trees is, and when we plant, and we just planted a tree this morning for Arbor Day, we typically put wood chip mulch around the trees, which is great, 2 to 4 inches in depth. The thing that I don't like to see is having the wood chip mulch right up against the trunk of the tree, and the bark is very succulent when it's young. And by doing that, you're insulating the soil, or you're insulating an area for the mice in the wintertime to go under there and then girdle the tree. So keeping wood chip mulch at least 4 to 6 inches away from the tree during the wintertime is a smart thing and will help to keep the rodents away.
Excellent. Let's go to Annie in La Crosse next. Annie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. This is really great. I have a question. I have a butternut tree in my front yard, and nothing except for grass will grow out there. So I'm wondering, can I put raised bed boxes up there and, fill them with soil? And will things grow above ground under near a nut tree?
Don't do that. You never should fill any soil, even a couple of inches around the base of a tree. It may not kill the tree, but it also may kill the tree, depending on how, on the type of tree and so forth. And you have a very good chance of rotting the bark, and you don't want to rot the bark on a large tree that you would then have to take down and replace. Don't do planting beds around trees.
Yeah. You see it all the time.
Yeah.
And it's also a competition for water and everything else. So thanks, Annie, for calling. Let's take a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, I'm Diana from Bayfield. Can you tell us a little bit about a fruit fly that is attacking berry crops and wild fruit locally? Is it here to stay, and do cold winters kill it off?
Jason Fishbach.
So that's our friend SWD, spotted wing Drosophila, moved into the state, into the Bayfield area 4 years ago now, and it's a fruit fly, and it has its ability to saw through unripe fruit to lay its eggs. So mostly our native fruit flies just go after damaged fruit. So it's been a big problem. It's changed the way we grow berries in the state. We never used to have to spray much for insects during harvest. Now we do to control it. There are good organic insecticides that work well and good sanitation where you pick up all that ripe fruit that drops and pick early and often can help, but I'm afraid it's here to stay. In terms of winter hardiness, we're still learning more. It's interesting as the life cycle proceeds through the fall, the flies that hatch out later in the year, what we call winter morphs, they're a little bit hardier, and so they survive the winters, apparently. So there's the endemic population, and then we suspect that they also move around in air currents. They'll blow up from the southern part of the state and move around that way, too. So it's a pest we're just going to have to learn about and learn how to manage. And unfortunately, it's one that's attacking ripe fruit, which is no fun because that's the worst time to have to spray something.
Okay. Let's take another call. Sandy in New Berlin up next. Hi, Sandy. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I'm calling because I didn't even realize how many questions I could have had just by the answers that have already been given. I listen almost every day, Larry, to your show, and that's why I know it's your birthday today. So I'm calling mostly to say happy birthday, Larry. And thank you for all the good programming you provide for all of us. Yay. And I'm applauding here at home, too. So thank you.
Sandy, thank you so much. Well, thank you so much. Actually, it is tomorrow. I lied one day on the show, or I forgot what day it was. And I was actually born on Mother's Day. What a gift. My mom always said, what a gift for Mother's Day, May 14th. Way back, quite a couple years back now. but thank you. I really appreciate that. All right. Let's take a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, Sylvia from Ashland. And 3 years ago, I planted 2 plum trees. They were doing beautifully. I had them caged. And they were getting so big that it was getting harder to prune. So I had them all nicely pruned, right? Well, when I took those big cages off, big mistake, a bear got in there and broke off my main leader.
Oh.
And so now my tree that was all beautiful and perfectly pruned is missing the central leader. Should I pull the whole thing out after 3 years or just leave it and see what happens? I tried mending the branch because it wasn't totally broke, so I ran the house and looked up online how to mend it, but it didn't work, so I had to saw it off.
Nuts.
I guess I would leave it and see what takes over and becomes your central leader, and if nothing else, you haven't expended any more energy, and you'd take it out if it doesn't make it. But I think that leaving it and cutting off that limb that was broken cleanly, but also not a flush cut, something outside the branch bark ridge so it can callus real well is the way to go. And I think another branch might take over, and it's not going to look real good for the next few years, but I think 5-6 years down the road, you may not know any difference.
So, Sylvia, you've got a decision to make in terms of what that tree, and the tree's going to tell you what it wants to do. So like Don's saying, you could let one branch take over as the new leader. That's one approach. The other one is to look at an open vase architecture where you have multiple leaders and you prune them out, and so the interior of the canopy is open, and so the sun gets in there. And that can be a real nice strategy for plums, because you can spread that tree out, keep it in a better picking zone for you. So see what the tree gives you and go from there.
That's great. Great points. Taking a call let's turn to Pete in Milwaukee. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I have two questions regarding my cherry tree. I have a tart cherry tree and a Queen Anne cherry tree. And I'm concerned about my Queen Anne because right where the branches start to sprout out, maybe 4.5 feet tall, I see a lot of areas where the looks like ants are starting to get in there. And each branch where it goes out, it looks like the bark is chewed up. Can I put Dawn detergent in there or just – I mean, the tree is maybe 20 feet tall. What should I do?
Well, that's a good question. Anybody have got any ideas among our Art Odie? Let's go to you.
Do you think that you have a branch that's structurally weak and separating from the tree? Is it causing the tree to leak sap out of a crack?
To be in there, but the tree is structurally good.
Okay.
So generally, the ants are not going to be causing any problem on your tree. So you're not going to want to just spray to kill the ants. They're there for a reason. They're not going to be excavating out a cavity in good wood. They're maybe taking advantage of some dead wood. So it may look sound, but it's not. If you've got ant activity. Again, you may have, like Art is talking about, structural problems where you do have a crack that developed. It may have calloused over once or twice, that crack, but you still have that cavity there. So you might consider pruning one or two to try to train it more to a central leader. Otherwise, you may just let the tree run its course and try to heal over that crack, and eventually the ants will disappear. But I don't see any reason why you would spray for the ants. It's not going to do any good.
No. There we go. All right. Thanks very much for that question. Let's see. Let's take another call. Well, okay, we've got a question from the audience. Let's go there.
I'd like to change my boulevard from lawn into a no-mow area, and I have two maple trees on there. And so I'm thinking about digging out the sod, and I also want to include a dry creek bed feature. Do I have to worry about damaging the roots of my maple trees when I do this project? Is there anything I should consider?
Well, maple trees are generally speaking shallow-rooted, so if you dig around in there, you're not going to be doing the trees any good. Are they mature trees or young trees?
I have a red maple, which I don't know. They've been there as long as I've been there, 10 years at least. So they're probably 20 or 30.
I would leave them alone if you want those trees. Are those city trees or are they your trees?
Yeah, I assume the city planted them.
Better leave them alone.
Don, what do you think?
I agree, and I know the forester there, so. Yeah, I mean, it's not going to – basically, anytime you add more than 2 inches of fill or you start removing more than 2 inches, you're starting to affect the roots. I mean, roots in any one tree, whether it's a large tree or small tree, are in the top foot and a half of the soil, 90% of the roots, and that's when you really start hurting them. And the thing is, you aren't going to see that initially. You're going to see that several years, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road. But, that wouldn't be a good thing to do.
All right, there we go. Back to the phones. Tekla in Pigeon Falls, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. First of all, I just wanted to make a comment besides my question. Our pear tree is 8 years old and blooming for the first time. And it's a standard. So I just, and my question is, rose chafers?
What do you do about rose chafers?
Right. We have an orchard, and we have just the double, you know, there's just like two of them together. They have destroyed our local cemetery some years, but we get them in our orchard and our rose bushes every year and try and think, is there anything we can do to get rid of them?
Okay. We got a few seconds here. Go ahead, Jason.
With that level of population, you're going to have to do something to kill them. So looking at some sort of a spray program. With the short time here, I think you can go online to our horticulture website with UW Extension, take a look at the Rose Schaefer articles, and it'll tell you some good control practices. Just make sure you look at those Extension websites because they're going to be some research-based and give you some good tips on if you're going to use chemicals, how to use them safely.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today from Bayfield, Wisconsin, for Bayfield in Bloom. We're kicking off that celebration with three guests, Jason Fishbach from the UW Extension and Ashland and Bayfield Counties, the Ag Agent, Don Kissinger from the DNR. He's Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator, and Art Odie, Horticulture Consultant, semi-retired from the Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management.
Identified those, which will likely be by the end of this year. Then we will propagate them and get them out for on-farm trial, and that's where things will start to get interesting. So hopefully by 2017, the first go-around will be for producers that provided plant material and see how things are going, and then at that point the hope is to make them more widely available. It's a long-term plant breeding project, so nothing happens quickly, but we hope here 2017 is the beginning of a more ramped-up commercialization of hazelnuts. And they'll likely be a mix of some hybrids, some pure American hazelnut. So stay tuned. There will be a field day up in Bayfield here where we have one of these Midwest performance trials. Information about that field day will be posted soon at the MidwestHazelnuts.org website, which is our information clearinghouse for the project.
Very, very cool. Now let's try once more. Let's go to the phones and talk to Zach in River West. Before we do that, Art, did you want to add something?
Yeah, you mentioned the lupins a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
And they're not quite in bloom yet, but our lupin season is usually the first 2 weeks of June. In a cool year, maybe they'll bloom a little bit towards the earlier part of June, and in a little warmer season, they'll bloom a little more towards the middle. But if people come up to see them, I would suggest sometime right about first or second week of June, you should see lupins, and they're a gorgeous display. They beat our daffodils all to pieces.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Zach in River West, thanks for waiting.
You got it. Hey, guys, so I'm curious about robins and kind of trying to figure out if they're friend or foe. Every time I go back into my garden, I see a bunch of them fly out. And last year, I actually had a couple get almost uprooted from them. And I assume that they're just picking at worms all day. And sometimes they're getting at my plants, actually. So should I try to do something about it? You know, I've also heard that, you know, it's kind of good to see them as some kind of pest control. So should I do something about it? Should I not? And if so, what can I do?
Well, they're the state birds, so you can't really can't do much of anything about it. But, and I wouldn't anyway. I don't know. Would you guys? Jason, would you?
Yeah, you know, they're eating insects, so I wouldn't worry about them. They might be causing some incidental damage if they happen to be hopping around, but you know, they're relatively small, so I wouldn't worry about it. Their behaviors change over time too, so you might see them now and then not see them for a while. If you were really concerned, you would have to use some sort of non-lethal approach, right? So you might have these big balloons that are called scare eyes that just looks like a huge hawk eye, basically. Or you can use some sort of a noisemaker or something to try to scare them off. But I wouldn't worry about it. I just enjoy them. They're there, yeah. And songbirds in your yard. What could be better?
Yeah, absolutely. We have, I had a gourd. I had the gourd gal on a month or so back, and she presented me with a nice, really kind of a curly Q gourd. So I've got to post a photo of it up on my Facebook page, and I bored an inch hole in the side of it and drilled three holes in the bottom. I set it out on a tree right next to our front porch, and not even a day, and I had a pair of chickadees nesting inside. It's really, really cool. It's fun to have those birds around. And they've got their water, a bird bath right there, and they got some bird seeds, so they seem happy. Anyway, let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Kathy. I'm from Rice Lake. Going back to the emerald ash borer, with all the trees that are being removed, is there any kind of effort or possibility of using that wood for woodworking purposes, or is it not viable?
That's a great question. And actually, there's been a whole, I guess, mini industry that's kind of grown in the urban forestry industry. We're trying to get communities or folks to use that wood. A lot of artisans and furniture makers, actually in the Eau Claire area, there's a gentleman who got a contract for a new hotel, and he's making headboards and then stools and bar seats for that too. But so to answer the question, basically, as long as you have removed the bark and probably the half inch of inner wood, the rest of the wood is good. And it is being used by a lot of folks. There's a company called Wisconsin Urban Wood. It's the nonprofit that is really trying to utilize and get other people to utilize wood. And if you could go to their website. But we have our forest products folks from the DNR, and we're trying to have them use that too, because it is a huge amount of wood that has many viable options, and many communities are starting to use their urban wood in that regard.
There's a big push in Dane County in southern Wisconsin. There's, like you say, kind of a little cottage industry growing up around using those ash trees.
And not only ash trees, but other municipal trees that we need to remove as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll go to Pam in Hartford next. Hi, Pam.
Hello. We put an orchard in. We've got about 10 trees that we put in 2013. And at the time, you know, we just had an existing lawn. And so we have still lawn in between the trees. And now we would like to mulch that whole area so we don't have to keep mowing around them, et cetera. Just wondering if you have a recommendation for the best way to kill all that grass.
Well, I just simply put a plastic barrier down around it, the size of the mulch area that you want to have, and kill that grass out during the summer and then do your mulching.
Yeah.
And, in fact, you might want, I don't know, you might consider putting down a weed barrier before you put the mulch down, but that's kind of an optional thing.
Yeah. And I guess with that mulch, too, just make sure that if you do have trees in the vicinity, you don't want to do what's called volcano mulching. You see that often, and it, basically where it's up against the trunk of the tree for several inches. Typically when we mulch, 4 inches is a max, and you may have to, you know, top dress it periodically. But, you know, when it's biodegrading, that's great nutrients in the future. But as Art said, you know, killing that grass, first of all, using the mat is a good idea. And you are going to get weeds coming up through that mulch no matter what you do. I mean, that's a given. But they're definitely going to be easier to pull.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for that question. Let's go back to our audience here. And who's next?
Hi, John from Ashland. And my garden is a carpet of purslane. I think I'm saying that right. And I know it's an edible. Am I in any danger of it strangling out, like my tomatoes, my peppers, and such?
What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, if you're using transplants and the canopy of your crop is above the purslane, because purslane doesn't get very tall, right? Then it shouldn't be a problem. It's actually working as what we call a living mulch. You've got to have adequate water, adequate nutrition, but it shouldn't be, as long as your crop plants are ahead of the purslane. If you're direct seeding carrots, for example, into it, it's going to be a problem. But transplanting, you should be okay.
All right. And we have, let's going to take another question from the audience, and then we'll go to Joshua in Mineral Point. Hi.
Hi, I'm Sandy from Roberts, Wisconsin. And I have two flowering crabs at the end of my driveway. And I'm just wondering, do I need to worry about fertilizing them? Or what should I do? Is there something I need to do to make them keep looking nice?
Just be sure that they get adequate water during a dry period. If you fertilize your lawn at all, that's probably enough fertilizer for them. Be sure that you keep them properly pruned and watch out for fire blight. Otherwise, you're probably fine.
Yeah, and they're a sun-loving tree, so as long as you're getting good sun to them, that's something as well.
And thanks for that question. Let's go to Joshua in Mineral Point, who's online next. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I was wondering, I do produce, and I was wondering, is it necessary? Now, I spread a hog manure bed pack on there, and usually either later in the fall or very early in the spring, and then I plow everything under, and I put lime on as well. I was wondering if it's, I was thinking about putting an organic fertilizer called Planter's Choice as a top dress. Is that necessary, or is that kind of overdoing it? I mean, I don't want to waste money if I don't got to.
Sure. Jason?
Well, so there are ways to figure that out, and it's called nutrient management planning. You can do this as a dairy farmer on a large scale, or you can do it as a home gardener, too. So if you look online, you can find the crop nutrient need for whatever you're growing, broccoli or whatever. It'll tell you how many pounds of nitrogen per year, per acre, so you're going to have to do the math to turn it into per square foot or per row foot or something. And you figure out how much it needs, and the idea is to fully meet that need during the year from whatever sources you've got. So the hog manure, even composted, you could just use a book value of maybe it's 15 pounds to the ton and do the math and figure out how close you get to the need of that crop, and then add whatever you need to fully meet that crop need. So that's kind of the book way to do it. You are going to have to look up some book values of the crop nutrient need, and you're going to have to look up what the book value is of the hog manure. Generally, it's a good idea if you can kind of spoon feed the plant, where you have some at the beginning of the year, some in the middle, some toward the end. Each crop's a little bit different how you spoon feed it, but as you kind of scale up and become more and more sophisticated with your growing, nutrient management's a big part of it. Most gardeners just kind of plant and hope, and whatever you get, you get. But commercial growers, you have to pay attention to that fertility to really get good production. So that's the way to start on that.
All right. Thanks very much. And a question from the audience.
Sue from Bayfield. I have about a half size of football field of brambles that have orange rust every year. And in lieu of pulling out every bramble, which is ridiculous, how can I get rid of this stuff?
So this is, you're trying to harvest and grow?
No.
This is just
rust. I mean, the brambles just are full of an orange rust on the leaves in the summer and fall. It's bad. It looks bad.
So if it's, it's defoliating, it looks bad. I was going to say, if you're not picking it, maybe you just let it run its course and nature is what it is. But if it's looking bad and you want to do something about it, it's a fungal disease that you're either going to have to spray for a preventative fungicide, which you probably don't want to do. Another approach is to mow it all down at the end of the year and try to get rid of that inoculum. Instead of having the floricanes grow, stay, and the primacanes carry it forth year after year, you mow it all down to kind of reset it, and you hope that you kind of starve out the fungus for a year and then start over fresh. But it's that scale, it's going to be a challenge. It may just be a disease that you live with, and in some years it's worse than others.
And thanks for that question. And boy, we covered a whole lot of material today, and I want to thank you all for listening today for Garden Talk here as we've been broadcasting from the Bayfield Pavilion to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. And a special thank you to our guest today, Jason Fishbach. Jason is a UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR. And Art Odie, Horticulture Consultant, semi-retired from Botanical Gardens and Arboretum Management. And this is the 14th year that there has been a Bayfield in Bloom, and it's the 14th year that we've broadcast from here. And I think it's the 14th year that Art Odie has been a guest, and I think it's the 14th year that Don Kissinger has been. He said so long ago, I don't even know anymore. Well, I'll tell you what. And Jason Fishbach's been doing it for quite, how many years now?
10 years now.
10 years. Oh, my goodness me. Well, it's always a lot of fun, and I hope we get a chance to come back next year. And I want to thank our audience today. You've been wonderful. And our audience right here in the Bayfield Pavilion, thank you so much. It's really a lot of fun for us to get on the road once in a while, a chance to meet some people and to talk about gardening and talk about communities. And I really appreciate it. And stay with us, though. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.